Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James. LeBron James with the rejection.
I'm officially recording on my end, so after a deep breath and a cold drink of water, if you want, we can get going right now.
Yeah, I'll grab a water. Go. Yeah, let's do it.
All right, sweet. Let's do this thing. Hey, Almighty Ballin' fans. I'm here today with Dave McMenamin, Cavs writer, and I've heard you called actually the LeBron Whisperer, but, you know, just great NBA writer and Cleveland guy through and through. Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I appreciate that. I don't know about the LeBron Whisperer. Got a reporter that knows how to talk hoops. I'll take that. But it's been fun to cover LeBron for sure.
Yeah. It must be amazing. And I messaged you about what we're going to be talking about today, which is LeBron and an MVP award. But the more that I thought about it while I was, you know, sitting down taking notes for this podcast, the more I thought about this possibility that he actually might go for Defensive Player of the Year. Have you thought about that?
You know, he's entering the year number 14 of his career. Defensive Player of the Year for a wing player is somewhat unprecedented. I mean, you got Jordan winning it and Peyton and Ron Artest, but it certainly the odds are against. Kawhi Leonard, of course, right. But wing players are rarer to win it than a big man. And then you throw in now LeBron has defied Father Time at every step thus far in his career. But at some point, I'm not sure if Defensive Player of the Year is going to be in the cards at this point. I think he had his chance. You know, his second and third year in Miami. But at this point in his career, I think he has seen the light in terms of body maintenance and managing the regular season to put yourself in position to be successful in the playoffs. And I think that's more important, the pursuit of ring number four than Defensive Player of the Year.
Part of me thinking this was too, because you remember when Kevin Garnett went to Boston and sort of tapered back a lot of his offensive role and sort of let Ray Allen and Paul Pierce and Rondo sort of take over and then focused all of his efforts on defense. And, you know, I was mostly thinking about this because, yeah, it's hard for a wing player to win Defensive Player of the Year. It definitely is. But I think this finals really pointed out to us that LeBron, you know, even if he's not playing the power forward or center position, is such a competent, actually probably the best rim protector in the league. He was sort of just scaring everyone on the Warriors out of the paint constantly. So that's part of what got me thinking.
Yeah, well, so I wrote about a 2,500-word oral history of the block he had on Andre Iguodala, about a week after the finals ended. So certainly, you know, that's one of the marquee defensive plays in NBA history. You think back to the finals that the Heat beat the Spurs. He blocked, I'm blanking on the center for the Spurs right at the rim. Another fantastic play with, he was traded to the Hawks. I'm just blanking
Thiago
on his name.
Splitter.
Thiago Splitter.
I was thinking Fabrizio Oberto for a while.
Another like marquee moment showing his defensive prowess. I just think it comes down to knowing what matters at this point. Not that he's not going to have sustained defensive effort and hold himself to a high standard when he's out there. I just think, you know, someone like Kawhi Leonard, that award is almost, a Rudy Gobert, players of that ilk, the award is almost, created for them over the next several seasons.
Yeah. You know, that makes sense. I'm still and I'm sorry to like break this news to you, I'm still going to sneak it back into the conversation over and over because it's what my you know, the beautiful mind, right? It's what my beautiful mind has been working on, like putting darts and pins on the board, saying like,
there you go.
Yeah, this is definitely it. It's all coming together. But with that being said, he does seem like, and he's talked about in the Open Run podcast that he was on, how despite his internal motivation being just go, 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 how he's learned and observed the sort of palpable evidence that, LeBron, you need to slow down if you're going to be able to make this NBA thing work for another decade. So I guess, you know, and I promise this will be the last mention of defense for right now. Has he discussed that, you know, on defense it is more of a wear and tear type thing? Is it, I guess I'm asking, is it easier for him to play offense as far as the toll on his body than it is for him to play defense in the type of way that chasing down Andre Iguodala or, you know, scaring people out of the paint would be?
Well, certainly he takes pride in his defense. I know, you know, based on conversations I've had with him, he's disappointed that he doesn't have Defensive Player of the Year on his trophy shelf yet. So that certainly leads your point, at least that it's, you don't dismiss the possibility, because if LeBron James wants to do something, he's proven the ability to go out and get it. And he also, I think, believes that his defensive presence in terms of organizing his team defense, in terms of being able to play literally all five positions on the defensive end, is one of the reasons why he is still a cut above Steph Curry, despite Steph Curry win back-to-back MVPs, because Steph Curry can't bring that type of presence to the defense out of the court. So it's an important part of this game. It's an important part of the reason why he came to respect Ty Lue in the first place, because Ty Lue was defensive coordinator in Cleveland before he took over for David Blatt midseason last year. It's still, though, LeBron has the luxury of Iman Shumpert, who can take the best wing offensive player at times. J.R. Smith did that at times last year. He's shown defensive strides. And they have Tristan Thompson down low, relied upon for taking the best post offensive player. So LeBron's allowed to pick his spots where he can have his biggest defensive impact, but he's not asked to do it, you know, 40 minutes a night, 82 games a year.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Part of him playing that way would be definitely the way that the defensive set makes LeBron the hub of the defensive wheel. So ultimately, that'll be up to Ty Lue. And, you know, that's another thing I sort of wanted to touch on the defensive end, too, because of the loss of Timofey Mozgov and, you know, like you mentioned, LeBron's not a post player. And then on the offensive end as well, it just seems like this Cavaliers team, although ultra-talented, is sort of a weird fit, and I am interested to see if you have any insight into what Tyronn Lue has in mind as far as, okay, my first NBA team, my first NBA offense that I've had actually a full, you know, offseason, a full summer camp to implement, this is what I want it to look like. Because I know he mentioned during the course of the year last year that he didn't really get the chance to implement a lot of the things that he wanted to because of the circumstances around his promotion, I guess we'll say.
Well, one thing we know, and he emphasized this from the first day he took over that Friday afternoon, and they played the San Antonio Spurs at home the Saturday night, is he wants them to play faster. And that is based on a couple points of reasoning for Ty. One, they have numbers. The analytics department of Cleveland is, you know, one of the more robust ones in the league. David Griffin, the GM, has always believed in that. That's kind of how he first made his bones in Phoenix front office, by being someone who did pay attention to these things when it wasn't in vogue. They see when the Cavs have LeBron James and Kyrie Irving in transition, when they have two-on-one breaks, three-on-two breaks, even man breaks, with those two guys involved, their offensive efficiency numbers are through the roof. I mean, you're talking like, you know, over 75% or in that range of times that they'll score when they get those opportunities. So Ty Lue wants to make sure that they get as many of those opportunities as possible to capitalize on that strength of their game. beyond that, there's just the psychological ploy of if we play faster, there's more touches. So there's more touches, more guys touch the ball. More guys touch the ball, they're probably going to score. They're going to be happy. And then that will transfer into defensive energy because at the end of the day, most guys aren't going to be motivated by what they do on defense. It's not enough for them. Even a defensive-minded player wants to get a touch around the rim like Tristan Thompson. Even a defensive-minded player wants to be able to put the ball on the floor or catch it on the wing and try to dunk it like Iman Shumpert. While that may be outside of their, you know, in-a-box skill set, you have to think of these people as human beings. And Ty understands that you got to give that carrot of you're going to have a chance to score and be a part of the offense as long as we defend. So it's not, you know, super highbrow in terms of his overall scheme. I mean, a lot of teams say they want to play faster. The Cavs actually have the personnel to do it. The hard part about it is, you know, they're going to have about 8 rotation players over 30 years old next year.
Right. Yeah.
And over an 82-game season, it can wear on you to play that fast style. And you're not just talking about LeBron, but, of course, you're talking about Richard Jefferson. You're talking about J.R. Smith. You're talking about Birdman and Mike Dunleavy, who they added this offseason. You're talking about Mo Williams, should he end up reporting to camp. We're not sure where he stands right now. There's a significant amount of their roster, James Jones, that is getting up there, and it makes you wonder how sustainable that is. But I think the reasoning behind it is sound.
Yeah, and, you know, with two guys in the open court like LeBron and like Kyrie, it makes sense that, you know, they do pretty well even when they're guarded. So unguarded, you know, their efficiency shoots through the roof. And, you know, all those guys that you mentioned, actually, they're either wings or big men. A lot of the age in the roster is, I guess, bottom heavy, if we're saying 1 through 5. So, you know, LeBron, he's a bigger guy. He's older. But Iman Shumpert, now Kay Felder, Kyrie Irving, the guards, the guys who are out on the perimeter defensively, they are the ones who are younger and seem to have the legs to be able to implement something like that, which I think is probably intentional. You know, you outside of, point guard Cavs, I'm doing it now, opted into his contract.
Mo Williams.
Mo Williams, right. Yeah. Outside of Mo Williams, who opted into his contract, you know, it seems like they have all this youth at the guard position, which, you know, normally they are the guys who are operating fast breaks anyways.
Right. And then, you know, it's kind of interesting or, I guess, emblematic of this Cavs team, but neither of us have mentioned Kevin Love yet, and that's certainly going to be a challenge for...
I feel terrible now.
Well, it's going to be a challenge for Ty Lue to get the most out of Kevin Love, and that was a detriment to the David Blatt era. He was not able to not only implement Kevin Love, but to motivate him and relate to him. Ty Lue's done a better job of the kind of psychological coaching with Kevin Love, but there is still some X's and O's that are to be desired, leave something to be desired, I should say. So when we talk about them playing fast, you know, how fast can you play while still making sure Kevin Love gets high post touches so he feels like he's fully integrated. So it's as you mentioned kind of at the top when we started talking about the makeup of this team, there are still parts that make you wonder, like, oh, you know, are they a perfect fit? I think what the Cavs proved last year in the postseason is that when they are at their best, they come with defensive intensity. And then on the offensive end, they're able to, you know, because they're so talented, almost just feed the hot hand when it gets going. That's how Channing Frye drops 27 points in an Eastern Conference Finals game. That's how, you know, you have Kevin Love having like a, you know, 12, 16 point quarter with regularity. You know, they're able to operate that way, and it works for them. It wouldn't work for a lot of teams, but it works for them.
Yeah. And, you know, the Kevin Love thing is interesting. I feel like maybe defensively what we saw in that, you know, first round Pistons matchup, playing him at center is all right if you have LeBron there to defensively, you know, play off ball or I guess off-ball shot blocker, you know, coming in from out of nowhere like a Serge Ibaka or something. But it doesn't sound like you think that LeBron wants to play a role like that because it is a very, like, dynamic, athletic, defensive role to play. But, you know, that being said, if you offensively are implementing him down in the post where he was at his best in Minnesota, then the whole reason he started to develop range in the first place is to hit those Dirk Nowitzki transition threes when he's trailing at the end. Mm-hmm. So, and that's one of the things that I think Tyronn Lue talked about, maybe not this offseason, so I want to, you know, see if you've heard anything about him mentioning that again, trying to implement Kevin Love into the post on defense, because in a weird way it makes sense for the trailing three-pointer type role that he could take as a big man, you know?
Right. I think that's an area that, you know, just someone who watches the game and knows Kevin's history, yeah, you can point to that as something they can look to highlight going into this year. But, you know, there's not a whole lot of NBA coaches in the offseason just talking about their potential X's and O's. So I don't have anything to tell you in terms of what Ty Lue has planned. He hasn't given me a look at the playbook. He's been enjoying his offseason out in Los Angeles. But, again, that's a logical wrinkle that you think that they could look to exploit a little bit more. But the balance that they're going to have to try to strike is trying to make sure Kevin feels involved and you're using his strengths without getting out of the flow of everybody else. And that's the same problem at times they have with Kyrie, because, again, he has the best handle in the league, and he can break just about every guy out in the perimeter off the dribble. And he has the ability to finish with both hands and draw contact and get to the foul line more often than not. And so how often do you rely on that? How often do you rely of Kevin Love running the high pick and roll? How often do you let LeBron just survey the floor? And, again, as long as the players trust one another, which they are able to develop over the course of last year in the playoffs, then you can do it. And because everyone knows it's like, we're just trying to get the win. Over the course of 82 game season, I think sometimes people's individual agendas pop up a little bit more. Yeah. You know, it's a long haul, and it's harder to strike that balance over the long haul.
You brought up a couple of times the psychological inevitability of, you know, defense versus offense, carrot versus stick type thing. And the Cavs, I think, are really interesting just as a team that is, I'm not sure if there's more like variability in their emotional states from 1 through 15, or if it's just something that they're willing to publicly demonstrate. But it is kind of odd that it seems like, you know, when things happen in the Cavs locker room, people tend to know about it. And, you know, when LeBron feels something, he's vocal about it on social media. And it just seems like LeBron at this point in his career is wearing his emotions on his sleeves. And it's a really odd but interesting way to go about it. It's almost like a realistic, okay, here's who I am and this is how it's going to be. And the team has sort of followed suit, because it's like they're gritty and they're like, okay, this is who we are. We don't actually want to play defense. So if we play more offense and score more points, we will want to play defense. And that's just like a realistic look. And it's humanizing, you know?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of the sign of the times. You know, one, there's the media landscape. The Cavs, you know, I'm one of four reporters over the last 2 years alongside Jason Lloyd and Joe Varden and Chris Haynes that were at, you know, 95% of all the practices and games, home and road. And then you throw in national reporters, my colleague Brian Windhorst, Adrian Wojnarowski, Michael Lee of The Vertical, Howard Beck of Bleacher Report, Jeff Zilgit, Sam Amick, USA Today, everybody descending on the Cavs, Ken Berger from CBS Sports descending on the Cavs on a regular basis. So there's going to be a lot of Cavs stories, and we all know what the fans are interested in. They're not interested in what they can see. They're interested in what they can't see. So you're trying to get inside the psyche and the relationships. And then you come down to just the way people there's almost like a want, in my opinion, and maybe this is being skewed by what I see on Twitter and the fans that choose to take the kind of the explosive side of every story. But people want to read into something. People want to read into when the Cavs are getting blown out at home to the Golden State Warriors back in January, and LeBron is looking miserable because he's losing by 30 points and muttering under his breath to Tyronn Lue on the bench late in the game. People want to assume that he's muttering about David Blatt and not about his frustration. I mean, that's just people's, it's in the worst part of people's nature. And we have, I feel like we've had five or six of those incidents, LeBron James whispering to Dwayne Wade on Christmas Day, the first year he was back in Cleveland.
People trying to read his lips.
People wonder, oh, he's trying to read his lips. He's going to go back to play with Dwayne Wade. That's what he's saying. And Kyrie Irving and LeBron are having a spat on the bench, and it looks like LeBron just told Kyrie to shut up. Oh, my God. Like, all these things. LeBron's sending a cryptic tweet. Like, all these things, I think the way fans are giving them attention, and you know, maybe the media is somewhat to blame here because, you know, say I report on it because there's an interest from the fans, and then my platform, I write a story for ESPN, and then I go on air to talk about it, then I go on radio to talk about it. It might give a small instance more weight than it really should get in the grand scheme of things. And I think with the Cavs, that has really been the reason why at times it seems so extreme. And I think in the playoffs, you saw a nice balance of, you know, someone like Richard Jefferson recognizing that, hey, like, I've been in the league 14 years, 15 years. I've been on teams that are a mess. This is not that. I'm going to go on my Snapchat and show people what we're like when the media is not around. And I'm all for that because my goal covering any team is just to give the most accurate portrayal. And I'm not invited to the team party down in the flats in Cleveland.
Oh, they're great. Trust me.
Nor would I want to be there. I got other things to do with my free time. But, you know, I can't give that same perspective. And so I think that's a good thing. And it was specifically to the Cavs example, it's a great thing. So people can actually understand that, you know, the good times are never as great as they seem. The bad times are never as bad as they seem. Much like any job, it's a very high paid job, and there's a lot of people watching it. There's a lot of attention there. But, you know, fundamentally, there are people with jobs, and you have varying relationships with your coworkers from day to day, and there's just more people paying attention to it.
I think part of it is that, you know, you mentioned sports fans and just humans in general want to speculate and sort of cover their hands over their mouth and whisper to their colleagues. It's like, oh, man, Janet's cozying up to Jeff a lot. You know, right. I think there's something going on there. I think that there's a tendency to create something if you don't ultimately know what it is. And so when you see ultra-polished people who are really guarded and don't show you their true self, then you assume that what's behind it is like a monster, you know, like it's, you know, there's a general distrust, I think, whether it's a modern, you know, sports reporting thing or whether it's something that's been here for a longer time and just sort of gets amplified through social media, where the whole polished look is increasingly distrusted, you know, and if you present a large enough body of evidence and you're a good guy, like I think LeBron is, then you can slip up and do stuff and you can have foibles. And I think LeBron's kind of petty. That's great. I'm kind of petty. You know, you know, I know that he's petty, but I also know that he's a good dude. And he, you know, gave, what was it, like $40 million to college kids recently.
Right. I mean, there's going to be over $80 million in contributions towards collegiate scholarships to the University of Akron through his program. Which is, you know, fantastic and really unrivaled in terms of his peers in social activism. I think a lot of things, they regress back to the mean. If you take the big picture of people, and I tend to believe that humans are generally pretty good, it's going to be a pretty good picture. But again, the way snippets are digested and picked apart, that I think it grabs eyeballs. And so, again, that's what I was saying. The media is part to play here. But it's also the fans and the people with interest in it. I don't know, because sports is escapism. there is an appeal to the reality TV side of it. And you hope that it's a sexier storyline, you know, but then you think about reality TV shows, they have hours and hours of footage and then they boil it down to 1 hour and then they kind of frame every character on that show into a certain light and they don't try to show the full picture. And I think that is, you know, again, as I mentioned before, that's something I strive to do in my coverage is I want people to actually have a fair representation. That doesn't mean that on a day when a teammates are fighting, I'm not going to report on it, but I'm not going to try to go the extra mile and say, well, this means that. I present the fact. If people want to have their interpretation of something, for instance, you know, we had reports in March after the trade deadline that Kyrie Irving wanted out of Cleveland. Well, that didn't make too much sense at the time.
Remember when Kevin Love went to LA?
Oh yes. or LeBron James, you know, took a 2-day vacation in Miami because he was the only player on the team to make the All-Star game and thus had that, and the team didn't have any practice schedule those days. So it wasn't shirking any responsibility. He was a multimillionaire with access to a jet and a beach that he could get to quickly. But that means he's going to go back to the Heat.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the stuff that it gets exhausting to cover a team because, you know, some players, they don't care. They don't care what the source is. They just see that the media fuels a story like that. And then it becomes harder to do your job and actually have the players trust you and try to get to the truth because they view you as just a member of the mass media.
Yeah, but, you know, at that same time, I think that LeBron has, in large part, been, just as he is with so many other things, really savvy and really smart about the way that, you know, and part of this has been through his own experiences, like the decision obviously had a negative lashback. You know, of course, he loves Cleveland and he loves Akron and he wanted to go back to Cleveland for that, but, I mean, he definitely knew that that was going to make him the hero, and he definitely knew that I think a lot of this stuff, a lot of the turmoil sort of fires or stokes the flames of the whole Cleveland narrative. And then even him saying like chasing the ghost, the intentionality that I think that LeBron operates with, I think is too significant to take that type of stuff and be like, that's not intentional. But at the same time, someone can be intentional and still be themselves, you know?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, as you mentioned, LeBron, in your opinion, is petty. I think that's a pretty, or he has some, you know, petty characteristics. I think that's a fair character assessment.
I'm petty. This isn't a hit.
But no, I'm not suggesting that. But so for you also to say he's intentional, that could be true. Like, I mean, you can be authentic. I covered Kobe Bryant for years. Kobe Bryant tried to make things so epic and dramatic, but that's who he is. Kobe Bryant now in post-basketball life is trying to create a new Star Wars. He did a great interview with Ramona Shelburne. Like, that's part of Kobe Inc. He wants to create this the next Star Wars, the next Harry Potter. Like, he wants to be the creator of this iconic, brand new storyline kingdom that will generate money and influence children for years to come.
Wow.
You got to be – that's the same guy who thought, you know, he could score 81 in a game, or the same guy who thought every time he got the ball late in the game that he's going to hit a game where it would be part of his highlight package they show in Springfield, Massachusetts before he's entered into the Hall of Fame. So, you know, the intentionality of LeBron James, the bringing up Michael Jordan's name, that's real. And that's the reason – on an off day in the summer that, you know, we're talking the week of his anniversary, third anniversary with his wife, Savannah, you know, he posted Instagram videos of him in the gym at 6 a.m, getting in a workout. The day after his anniversary, he said, man, this is a tough workout today. I shouldn't have drank wine all day yesterday with my wife for my anniversary. Like, that's really who he is. So, you know, you could say, you know, you could roll your eyes and think it's insufferable, but you know, you look at the results, and I think you have to kind of respect the process and the man because it's worked for him thus far.
Yeah, it definitely has. And, you know, I have so many conflicting feelings because I want to say, like, hey, You know, actually, hey, I'm just going to do it. I'm sorry. I have to go back to the Defensive Player of the Year thing. I can't help it. Right after they won the championship, he brought it up for no reason, right? And, like, that's the way to continue the narrative, right? Win Defensive Player of the Year. That's how you chase Jordan.
Yeah, I mean, it's a part of his resume that he, you know, hasn't been able to match Jordan. The funny thing is that, you know, Jordan played alongside one of the great wing defenders of all time in Pippen. And, you know, that is never, maybe it's undershadowed where, you know, that afforded Michael Jordan, it was a great luxury to have. And yeah. LeBron, certainly, you know, Dwayne Wade in his prime was an excellent defender. You know, Andy Varejão earlier in his career was an excellent defender, but, you know, he never had first ballot Hall of Famer alongside him the entire career, providing that type of thing. But again, people pick and choose, you know, Jordan's 6-for-6 in the finals, LeBron's 3-for-7. That makes Jordan better. Well, what about the fact that LeBron's already made more finals? That meant that Jordan more often than not didn't reach the finals. That meant he exited earlier. Some reason a conference finals loss for Jordan looks better than a finals loss for LeBron. That doesn't make any sense. Kobe put it this way years ago. He said, I just want to be in the conversation for the greatest players of all time. LeBron's already there. All he can do is enhance the argument for his case. And, you know, it doesn't look like he's slowing down anytime soon. He's entering year 14. We have seen primes shift before our eyes, and he may be the most shining example of that. Who's to say he won't have 3 more sterling seasons? Who's to say he won't have 5 more sterling seasons before he starts to slow down? And then we're really going to see the staggering numbers pile up, because he's already knocking on the door, top 10 scoring. He has the most assists ever for a wing. He passed Pippen last year for that. All his playoff numbers are creeping up and up and up. There was a stat since the year 2000 in the NBA Finals that I tweeted the other day.
Retweeted. I saw that. I was going to bring it up.
All 5 major statistical categories, LeBron's number one. You know, more points than Kobe in the finals, more rebounds than Shaq and Tim Duncan. You know, more assists than, you know, et cetera, et cetera. More threes than Steph Curry. I mean, it's staggering. And it's only going to continue.
You know, one thing that he did mention, though, and I think this is interesting, and I'm just, I guess, going to ask you to speculate on it. I remember Kyrie Irving went off in a game against Toronto, I think the season before last, and he mentioned, I think he thought that someone asked him if Kyrie Irving was a potential MVP, and LeBron said, yeah, I think Kyrie Irving's going to eventually win an MVP. Where does Kyrie Irving fit into this whole conversation? Because I think that, you know, there's a universe where if LeBron takes a step back to rest on offense a little bit and, say, focus on the defensive end or get rest, and Kyrie shoulders more of the burden, because I think that LeBron trusts him even more after the finals for good reason, I think that Kyrie Irving could surprise a lot of people next year.
Right. Set in that scenario, it was against Toronto. You know, Kyrie had maybe played about 10 games or so at that point, coming back from his knee injury. And it had just become clear, either the All-Star voting was final, or it became clear that you know, Kyle Lowry would end up being the starting point guard over Kyrie Irving. So that the question was, you know, and again, Kyrie had a great game against Toronto, torched Lowry, and the question was presented to LeBron, like, you know, shouldn't Kyrie be an All-Star? And he's like, I'm not even worried about All-Star for this kid. He's in store for much bigger and better. And, you know, I think it was tactical, intentional, as you frame it, to give some confidence to Kyrie and put it out there, you know, manifest destiny. Kyrie will be MVP. That's where your head should be at. This is where your goal should be. I think that is the succession plan. And when he decided to leave Miami for Cleveland, he knew how talented Kyrie Irving was. This is a guy who's been participating in Chris Paul's skills camp for years and years and years. You know, Chris Paul's like a brother to LeBron. He's had inside scouting report. But there hasn't, in LeBron's estimation, always been the work ethic to match the its talent. And that is the catch-up game that LeBron has, you know, pined about. And, you know, to his credit, he doesn't really try to pin it on people, certain players by name. But, you know, when LeBron talks about teaching good habits, et cetera, more so this first season back in Cleveland than this one. But that, you know, Kyrie was certainly one of the candidates that, that he was referring to. And certainly anyone who watched the Cavs, they saw a greater commitment from Kyrie Irving. I only covered him the last 2 years, so I can't speak specifically to it. But there was certainly a thought, talking to people who covered the team before I got to Cleveland, that, you know, Kyrie was really just living off his skills before. And he's taken his body to another level since LeBron's gotten to Cleveland. He's taken his film study to another level. He's taken his maturity away from the court to another level. And that is, those are the reasons as much as his skill that he has a chance to be an MVP in this league. And, you know, I had people tell me, I was at USA Basketball training camp this summer. I had two people involved with Team USA tell me that Kyrie Irving is a better basketball player than Steph Curry.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of a cop-out, but it depends on your definition of better. I think that in large part, Cleveland won last year's playoffs because they had better players in one-on-one situations. And when everything grind to a halt, their players one-on-one could beat the other players one-on-one, especially because of the lockdown defense of one Kevin Love, you know?
Exactly.
Clutch defender Kevin Love. But, you know, a couple more things before I let you go. You know, one directly connected to what we were just talking about. I'm not sure if you saw that Kyrie Irving was ranked 25th in the Sports Illustrated Top 100. Did you see that?
Yes, I just saw the tweet with his ranking, so I can't really compare it against where other guys land, but I did see that. You know, at first blush, without reading the reasoning or seeing the names above or below him, it seems significantly low for me.
Yeah. I guess, you know, my question to you was, are there going to be more fires tonight than there were after the championship because people are going to be lighting houses on fire and rioting over that? Or
I think the Cleveland fan base is in a pretty good spot right now where, you know, things are just rolling off their back. The RG3 thing isn't really even phasing them because they know they're going to have championship ring night on October 25th against the Knicks at Quicken Loans Arena. So I think something as subjective as a ranking, and, you know, of course I'm not going to criticize the SI for having a ranking. ESPN's had NBA rank for years now, and that always stirs up discussion, negative or positive, for players where they end up. I don't think it's something that the fan base will get too riled up about.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either. And no, I mean, you're an ESPN guy. I'm definitely down to criticize Sports Illustrated for a while. If
that's something that you wanted no, to. No, I'm not gonna.
I can respect a company man, you know. but yeah, the last thing I sort of forgot what the last thing was. Let me check my notes.
All right, what do you got, Chris?
Thankfully, I can edit audio. People won't think I'm completely incompetent. Man. I might have just totally forgotten. No way. But
you want to do like predictions or something like that, or I think was that something you Facebook messaged me? I can't remember.
Oh yeah, well I messaged you about the awards or the award predictions. That is something I do want to do, is get your insight. I, you know, throughout the course of this conversation, I've had to, you know, speaking of audio editing, edit out a lot of instinct for me to just wildly speculate on things.
Okay.
Yes, like, but you know. Whatever it is, what it is. I mean, do you think that there's a legitimate chance of either Kyrie or LeBron winning MVP? And do you think that there's a universe where LeBron does sort of do the whole Kevin Garnett thing and just, like, you know, just hammer it down on the defensive end?
I thought you promised me no more defensive end of the year questions. Again,
okay, and I can podcast. Awesome. Put your name on it on social media so people listen to it thinking that it's you. And it's
No, let's not do that. Let's start with the MVP.
Yeah.
I think there's two schools of thought here. One is LeBron will have so much pressure off his shoulders. They want it. They've proven that they're the best team in the league. Everybody's going to be taking the scrutiny to Golden State and picking apart the relationship between Steph and KD and Draymond. Who's going to babysit Draymond now that Luke Walton's coaching the Lakers? And is Steve Kerr going to be healthy? And, you know, is Andre Iguodala falling off? You know, so that's becomes the new circus. And LeBron can just do his thing, put up a near triple-double every night, win 60-plus games in the weaker East. And since he kind of reminded the entire world that, yes, he is the best basketball player last year in the finals, that he adds that fifth MVP.
Yeah.
So that's one school of thought, and I can see it happening. Certainly the way LeBron has approached the offseason, you would think he is a man with that in mind. The other school of thought, and I think his mentality has shifted ever since he took that sabbatical in January 2015 to get his body right, is that as much as a fifth MVP would be nice, a fourth ring matters tenfold. So whatever he has to do in the regular season to get himself ready for the playoffs is more important than any regular season award. I'm more on the second scenario where he's going to manage himself. And, you know, if he plays 65 games, so be it. Now, he would probably, you know, if he heard this podcast or if I say that to his face, he'd probably disagree with me. Last year, he told us he planned to play in all 82 games. It didn't happen that way.
He does listen to this podcast, by the way.
Okay. Well, I mean, you listen to his podcast, Open Run or Open Floor or whatever, so it's only fair. Right, exactly. So I think that is, you know, again, he's not anyone to rest on his laurels, and certainly he's as motivated as ever. I just think I know that when he talks about chasing Michael Jordan, it's not chasing MVP trophies, it's chasing rings. As for Kyrie Irving, he should be in that conversation, but in the same way that people think KD and Steph Curry may split the vote, of course, LeBron and Kyrie will split that vote. I mean, there are some people, I think a vocal minority, I'd call them, who think Kyrie should have been the MVP of the NBA Finals. I think that's absurd, but there are some people out there. But, you know, again, Kyrie didn't even get consideration because, you know, LeBron got all the votes for NBA Finals MVP. I think the way things are, way talent is distributed in this league, you're more likely to see a Russell Westbrook winning MVP, a guy who's never won it. Maybe a healthy Anthony Davis. I mean, I think I'd bet that we have a new league MVP next year.
Yeah, that's interesting. I really liked the Pelicans until I heard about the unfortunate circumstances with Drew.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the Thunder. I just think, you know what? Here, I've given up. You know, I'm just gonna go for broke and say, you know, Kyrie's going to win MVP. LeBron's going to win Defensive Player of the Year. Coach Lou's going to win Coach of the Year. And then LeBron's going to retire and then buy the Cavaliers.
Wow. Well, hey, I'll certainly give you credit on social media if that comes to fruition.
Yeah. You know, whether or not that was the last point I was trying to remember, that's going to be my last point. Thanks so much for coming on, man. You know, we can definitely, I'll pencil you in for, do you know when the Defensive Player of the Year is announced?
Well, it depends on, it'll be sometime in the playoffs, but depends on which team that player is on and how they're doing in their first round series. Like sometimes, you know, they expect the team to win the first round, all of a sudden they fall down 2-1, and then they have a Defensive Player of the Year ceremony because they don't want to have a situation like they had with Dirk Nowitzki in 2007, I guess. Exactly. Most awkward MVP press conference of all time.
That hurts me so much right now. But yeah, I once LeBron wins Defensive Player of the Year, I can have you back on to talk about it. So thanks a lot, man. So are you a Twitter plug type of guy, or do you have an article you want to plug?
No, I'm just trying to plug my last week of summer vacation before training camp. So, you know, people know where to find me.
they definitely do. Dave McManaman covers the Cavs, works for ESPN, company man through and through. Doesn't have bad things to say about Sports Illustrated, though. And, yeah, definitely appreciate him coming on my podcast. So, thanks a lot.
You got it. Thanks, Chris.
All right, have a good one.
All right, take care, man. Thank you.
Napa know-how.
Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolor paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.